Good morning. So last time we started talking about optimization techniques. We talked about things like simple things like avoiding calling a function over and over again in the loop. Talked about some automatable things like, well, even if we're calling a function, we have to do that work. We can move that work without doing a call and return instruction. Call that inlining. We talked about loop unrolling, where if we were executing a loop a lot of times, well, we don't need to compare and increment every time. We can kind of put that work together such that we're doing work for multiple iterations of the loop once, and this avoids instructions for actually managing, say, our indices. And when we finished up, we saw these performance results where we found out that we were getting less and less instructions per element. So if we look at number of elements in the loop versus the number of instructions run, it's getting better and better the more loop unrolling we did. And this made sense because we were getting rid of instructions to say increment I. We were doing that once for say every 32 items instead of once for every item. Instructions to compare I to N to figure out whether a loop was done. We were doing that once every 32 and the except for the leftover, and in this case, there was none to deal with. So that got better and better, but our performance actually hit a wall. That initially, on the machine I was testing on, we were at 1 1/3 cycle per element, and we got down to just about 1. And then nothing happened. So we'll talk later today about why this happened. Our book calls this a latency bound. So there's something that is happening here where we can't get any better. And the way our processor is executing this is not like the processor we're used to, the processor we built, where every instruction needs to take some amount of time. In fact, it needs to take at least 1 cycle. That's not happening here. Clearly, our loop has multiple instructions in it. We're executing and ends up more than 1 instruction per cycle. But the way that happens has some limits, and that's why it doesn't, we aren't continuously getting, like we started out with, about 3 instructions per cycle. It doesn't actually end up that good. We end up hitting a limit, and we'll talk about avoiding that limit. So before I get into that, some logistical notes on upcoming labs and homeworks. So we have some labs on performance. So these were made last semester, and they're slightly revised versions of this that we will have for this semester. So the one this week is on loop optimizations, including loop unrolling and something called multiple accumulators, which we'll talk about today. And in those labs, we're going to give you some assembly code and have you implement these optimizations and time them. I'm not going to guarantee they'll all do something on every machine you test them on. These are things which vary between processors, depending on what capabilities the processor has. Next week, we'll have a lab on vector instructions, aka SIMD, aka, which maybe you read about. We had an aside in your textbook that was part of the reading, so we'll be working with those. And these both sort of lead into 2 homeworks, but this is less direct than many of the labs and homeworks we had before. So we have 2 performance homeworks, which are both image manipulation tasks. Why image manipulation? Because it's easy to have a big image to deal with. The first task is to rotate an image. So we give you an image, possibly a big one, ask you to produce an image that's rotated. The image is represented as an array of pixels. Talk about it in a second. And the second task is to smooth or blur an image. So basically to make every pixel in the output the average of a little square of pixels in the input. And these assignments have a peculiar image representation. We have this struct we call a pixel, which is a red, green, blue, and alpha byte. We have an alpha component to represent transparency. The real reason this is in the assignment is it turns out that the optimizations you're going to want to do work out a lot less annoyingly if the size of a pixel is a multiple of 2. Or multiple of, it turns out, a power of 2 number of bytes. It turns out to work out a lot better. And we're going to have this be represented as a flat array like we've seen when we did the cache blocking examples. So x equals 5, y equals 4. We're going to take our dimension, our width of our image, times y plus x. That's how we're going to do it. So we're going to have one big malloc call to allocate the whole thing as one contiguous array. We're not going to do something where we allocate each row separately, because that's a lot of overhead and not what people do in the real world when they want to manipulate images. And so for rotate, this is what the code we're going to give you is look like. We're going to give you this code, possibly formatted a bit differently. And your goal is to make a faster version of this. That is the only parameters in the assignment. We tell you on our machine, which you don't have direct access to, it needs to be a certain amount faster. So you need to write another version of this, which you need to submit in a C file, that is a certain amount faster on our machine. So first, let's talk about some weird things in the code that we're supplying you. We have this radix thing. This is a preprocessor macro that does the index evaluation. So this ends up being the same as here, as source of I times dim plus j. And you can use it or you cannot. It's what the originators of this assignment, which are our textbook authors, used. And it's a preprocessor macro, and I'll explain briefly so you can read the header file we supply and figure out what's going on. So you know probably about pound define. Usually you've done it to like just do header files, but it's a more powerful thing than that. And one thing it supports is you can have pound defines, which kind of look like functions. So here I have my pound define double, x times 2, and this expands to this. And this is a text substitution. So the compiler actually produces that text and compiles that. And this has some weird effects, which is why the macros we provide are written the way they are. So that double function, if I do 3 plus 3, this literally expands to 3 plus 3, replacing x, times 2. Which will not produce the result you expect. So this is why, if you look at the header file, we have these seemingly meaningless parentheses around the parameter that is precisely to prevent this problem from happening when you use the macro. So when we do the text substitution, we have parentheses, so the order of operations is what you expect. And radix is just x times n plus y if we have x, y, n. That's what it expands to. You don't have to use it. You can just write, you know, the expanded version if you like. You can use pointer arithmetic instead of indexing. Whatever works, we, you know, don't care, just use what is clearest for you and actually efficient. Okay, so that's some logistic notes. So this is our task, is to just rearrange the pixels for the first part. The second part, we take the average of a block of pixels. So the way grading is going to work is that you're going to submit a C file. We will compile it on my machine. The grade will be the best performance. You can have multiple variants of the function in one file. There is a time limit for how long we will run things, but it's pretty generous. Like, don't submit 1,000 variants. It will run out of time, but it's pretty generous. And grade is the best performing one in our machine. And there's some threshold you have to get for rotate. It needs to be a little less than 2.6 times faster to get full credit, and we have partial credit at another threshold, 75% at another threshold. These thresholds are spent based on, I know if you do certain optimizations, you can get that fast. Since it's on my machine, which is a different architecture, a different microarchitecture than the lab machines, there's a web viewer for results. So if you submit something to Archimedes, sometime like 30 minutes to an hour later, depending on how many submissions there are, you can view the results on a web page, which will have a breakdown for each version you submitted. Here's how fast it ran on each size we tested on my machine, since you don't have access to that. You can test on your own machine, and I recommend it. Generally, if something is faster on your own machine by a lot, it's still going to be faster on my machine, but the amounts will vary. Like, it might be 3 times faster on your machine and 2 times on mine, but if it's like a lot faster, it's probably still going to be a lot faster. The big caveat is that if you're not using the same compiler, you can get in more trouble. So this comes up with Mac OS X. Sometimes on Mac OS X, GCC is Clang. And on our lab machines and the machine I'm testing on, GCC is GCC. And that can make a huge difference because these are different compilers that are completely different code bases, and they might write loops as very different assembly. But generally, usually, if something's faster on your machine, it will be faster in mine, just by a different amount. Because like I have different caches and all that stuff. Okay. So for the rotate part of the assignment, please try things that seem applicable. So you should think about what's the likely bottleneck here? Why is this slow? And try optimizations which seem applicable. You should vary numbers. Like, just because unrolling a loop 2 times doesn't work, or cache blocking with a certain size doesn't work, doesn't mean the technique is completely useless. Or if you find it works, you might be able to make it a bit better by trying different numbers. So don't just try one number. Note that you can combine techniques, and some techniques might not do anything until you combine them, because of the phenomenon we talked about where like I was waiting for my arithmetic to happen until I improved the performance of the arithmetic. So that sort of thing might happen to you, so you try, just because something didn't work before you fixed another thing doesn't mean it won't work at all. And a bunch of techniques combine really well. So for example, loop unrolling and cache blocking are kind of best friends. Loop unrolling and multiple accumulators, which we'll talk about today, are things you basically have to do together. And these are things that are useful to know. So for rotate, I'm giving this general advice because we're not going to tell you what to do. We're just going to tell you a threshold. You can tell you what optimizations we talked about. You need to figure out which ones make sense. For the second part, which I hope have posted this week, which is going to be similar to last semester if you want a preview, we're going to give a threshold, and we're going to say you can do anything, but we're going to give some very specific advice which we know does it. Like, we're going to give, if you do X, Y, Z, and W, when we did this, we got this speed up. We're not going to do that for the first part. For the first part, you need to figure it out. And the reason we're doing it for the second part is that the coding task on the second part is substantially more difficult. For the first part, the code you have to write is probably not that complicated. It's more figuring out what makes sense to do. Yes?
How quick is the feedback from Archimedes?
How quick is the feedback question when it's running on my machine? So I have something which like checks every 5 minutes, but it runs the submissions in order by the last time one of your submissions was run. So you could wait in line. And you'll wait less in line if it's the first time you submitted ever. But that's how it works. And a note on another issue is that these can be done with partners. So you can do it individually if you want to. You can do it with one partner, one, not more than one partner, for each of these assignments. We would suggest that you and your partner have some time that you can come to the same lab so you can talk to the TAs together and we don't play tag with your partner. Also that you should work together because the point of having partners is that if you run into like nothing I'm doing is working, hopefully you'll have someone with an idea about what might to think about what might be happening. Okay. So I mentioned here that some techniques combine well. And one point that people got very confused about when we talk about these multiple optimizations is that they confuse some of these optimizations that combine well. So loop unrolling and cache blocking, they combine well. They combine so well that people often think they're doing loop unrolling when they're really doing loop unrolling and cache blocking. So for example, this at the top, that's cache blocking and loop unrolling. So I'm cache blocking by, you know, if I start, assuming I started with the normal Kij loop where I was incrementing each by one, I'm changing how much I'm incrementing in the outer loop, but I'm doing the additional operations in the innermost loop. And that means I'm changing the order in which I access A and B, right? I can't do this, for example, if I don't know there's no aliasing. Like, that would be wrong. Like, this is not just loop unrolling. Versus the second one is loop unrolling because I'm just duplicating the innermost loop. I'm not changing the order I do anything. I still access Bij, then Bij plus one. In the first one, I access Bij, then I access Bij again. I change the order versus without the transformation. That doesn't mean the first thing is bad. The first thing is often very good because you're doing cache blocking. If cache performance is a problem, that could help a lot. But it's not just loop unrolling. And I want you to know this, because if you do the first thing and it helps, your thought should be, oh, there might be some cache thing going on here. What other ways can I do? What other ways can I think about improving the cache performance? Okay, so any questions about this? Yeah.
What did you say was the amount faster that?
So it's in the assignment. It's a little less than, so for, I think the threshold was, I forget whether there's a 70 threshold to get 75%, which is either 1.5 or 1.6 times faster. It's in the assignment. And there's a threshold to get 100%, which is a little less than 2.6 times faster. This is on my machine, so it's not like quite representative. It's in the assignment if you want the full details of exactly how grading works. And there will be different thresholds for the smooth assignment. For the smooth assignment, you'll have to do stuff with SIMD, which is a lot more complicated, which is why we give you, like, you can do this, this, and this instructions. But the, you know, speed up we expect from doing that is like over 3. And the speed up of like a really good solution, which we don't expect you to do, is like 12. Versus the speed up on rotate of a really good solution is like a little less than 5. And this is, by really good solution, I mean if you're like, well, this is, I try to like do the right thing, knowing things that we don't teach. Like, it's probably about what the machine is capable of doing. Okay, so let's talk, as I said, about this latency bound issue that I promised I'd get back to. And to understand that, we have to understand how CPUs work. And we kind of alluded to this briefly when we finished up talking about pipelining. We mentioned that CPUs execute multiple instructions at once and do it out of order, whenever values are available. So if you remember our idea of out of order, is that we, you know, we have like a slow memory access, and rather than saying, yep, I have that slow memory access, I can't keep going. You know, I need the result of R8. I can't execute that subtract. I'm just gonna stop doing work. That's not what we say. What we say is, oh, I have this add. I can do that add. Let's do that add now. Oh, I have this XOR. I have this XOR. I can do that. Let's do that now. And we just keep doing things, you know, as long as we have work. And the idea is we can hide this latency. And we can combine this with executing multiple instructions at once. And this is what modern processors do. So they're executing instructions when the values are available, you know, just not waiting for things, and they're doing multiple ones at once. And this means when you look at a high-level picture of a modern processor, we don't have like our normal pipeline diagram, but instead you have something that might look something like this. So we fetch multiple instructions at once. So we're fetching multiple instructions per cycle. There's some very complicated logic here in dealing with what if I have a jump, that we're not going to talk about how that works. Needless to say, that's one of the reasons we don't try to have you implement this. And we decode that. And then we have what I'll kind of call an instruction queue. We have a list of pending instructions. So we just have all the instructions that we need to run. And we're going to take things from this list whenever the values the instruction needs are is available. And this is also where, in this processor design, we're going to handle all our forwarding. So we're keeping track of where the values come from. This is also how we're handling forwarding in this design. And whenever we have operands available, we send the instruction with the values we got to multiple what we call execution units, things that actually can do the work. So in this case, we have a processor with two identical ALUs and a third ALU, which is multiple stages. So maybe the two ALU 1 and 2 can do like additions and subtractions. ALU 3 maybe can do additions, subtractions, and multiplications and divisions. Something like that. And we have also a functional unit to access the cache. We have a load store functional unit that handles loads and stores. So we send these operations into our pipeline whenever they're into these functional units pipelines whenever they're available. And these functional units themselves, as you can see, sometimes have pipelines themselves. Like sometimes our pipeline inside internally. Which means in the case of our ALU3, presumably that's a two-stage pipeline and we can send it like one multiply every cycle. Even though it takes two cycles to do it. So after the functional units finish up, we have something where we have to collect all the finished instructions. So this is something that's called a reorder buffer. It's called the reorder buffer because we're doing our instructions in some random order based on when values are available, and the reorder buffer is going to put them back in order. And we need to do that so we can actually record right back our values in order. If you see my picture of this out of order processor, we do all the write back stages so it's still in order, so we always have consistent values in the registers. So we're just still doing forwarding, so it's not that the values aren't available, but we want to make sure we have a consistent set of values, so like if we have a branch misprediction, we know what to do. We know how to get the values that we want. So this is also used to help handle forwarding, so we have the completed values there, and that's somehow communicated to the instruction queue to know, hey, you can run this instruction, here are the values from the prior instruction for it. And also, when we have like branch misprediction, this is going to figure out, okay, I just ran these instructions I shouldn't have run, where are their values, what are the things that needed them, let's get rid of them, but still make sure I have the results of all the other instructions. So any questions about this sort of general design? So this is the high-level view of basically all modern high-performance desktop and laptop processors. So let's talk more about what the instruction queue looks like when we're doing an out-of-order processor. So I'm going to have this loop here. So I have a loop with a couple of instructions, a compare, and a jump to go to the beginning of the loop. And we put instructions in our instruction queue. And the first thing to notice is that the instructions I put in my instruction queue take into account branch prediction. So my processor, even though I haven't executed the JNE, we've predicted what's going to happen, and we put in instructions based on that prediction. And in the good case, and almost all the time when you're writing high-performance code, hopefully, the branch prediction is right. So we're just going to have these extra instructions. We still have to execute the jump, but the execution is just, do I have to fix something? And usually the answer is going to be no. And in this processor, we have two ALUs. So our ALUs Each of them can do an addition or a comparison or check the flags, which is necessary to execute any one of these instructions. So we have two ALUs to assign these instructions. And in our instruction queue, in addition to keeping track of the instruction and its number, we're going to keep track of its status and its dependencies. So some instructions, we have the values already. So in the case of this add queue, we're saying, I know the value of REX and RDX it needs. That's available. I can run this right now if you want me to. And we have this instruction too, where we say, oh, I need the value of RDX for this. I'm waiting for one to tell me what that value is, waiting for instruction one to finish. And similarly, for instruction three, I'm waiting for its value of RDX in order for it to run, so I'm waiting for instruction two, and so on. So we have all these dependencies here that we are recorded in our instruction queue, at least conceptually, that it's going to check as we complete instructions. And what the instruction queue is going to do is it's going to scan its list of statuses and take the ready instructions, and it's going to put as many of them as it can on the execution units, which are also called functional units, the things that can actually run the instructions. So in this case, we scan the list, we find out we have one thing that's ready, so we're going to put that on an execution unit, and we're going to start running it. So notice that I have a second ALU. I can't use it because I just don't have values to give it. This is a thing which happens surprisingly often in modern processors. And keeping this from happening is a key idea of getting good performance out of a modern processor. So we're in this case where we can do an extra calculation, but sorry, we don't have any values to do it. So this runs on that first execution unit, and let's say it takes one cycle to do an add. So when we're starting cycle two, it's going to be ready. It's going to be done, and therefore, where previously we were waiting for one, now that's ready. So we do our same thing. We scan our instruction queue for every single ready instruction, put as many of them as possible in ALUs. We find out again, well, we have two ALUs, but we can only put one instruction there. Yes?
Sorry. So here, a cycle is like a full execution of the instruction, not just a pipeline stage?
So here, a cycle is a clock cycle. We're assuming that the execution unit, when we give it an instruction, finishes it up in that one cycle.
Okay.
Obviously, in a real processor, maybe we need some extra cycles, depending on how the ALU and the instruction queue works. So during our second cycle, we can schedule instruction number two on our first ALU. It's going to finish up, and then we'll have that done. And we still didn't use all our ALUs. So we finished that, and we advance to instruction number three, which was waiting for two. When two finishes, we find out, okay, it was ready, and then we could run it on ALU 1. So when that finishes, note that we have two instructions here that depend on instruction 3. So when instruction 3 finishes, we're going to end up having two ready instructions. So finally, we're going to have a chance to run two different instructions at the same time, taking advantage of the fact that we built two ALUs in our processor. We're finally using them. So these both are ready, and we're going to try to put as many things as possible in our ALUs. So we end up putting both instruction 4 and 6 in our ALU. Note that because I did branch prediction, I'm skipping over a branch, and that's fine because I know I'm going to ignore the results of instruction 6 if I find out that I mispredicted the branch. That's part of the job of my reorder buffer. It's going to collect these results, and we're going to get rid of it if it turns out that when I execute instruction 5, I find out I shouldn't have done it. So we execute both 4 and 6. And when these finish, we're going to be able to run both instruction 5, which is going to use the condition codes from instruction 4. So that's what its input is. And instruction 7, which is going to use the value of RDX from instruction 6. So these become both ready, and again, we look through our list of ready instructions and we say, which of these can we run right now? And we say, well, we have two places to put them, great. So then these finish, we look for anything that depends on instruction 5, we don't find anything, and when instruction 7 finishes, we find we have one thing that was waiting for it, and that becomes ready, we run that, and we keep going. And so on. So this is sort of the kind of operation the processor is doing internally. So you'll observe that the bookkeeping here is a lot more complicated. We need to figure out all the dependencies. Whenever an instruction finishes, we need to somehow find all instances of that dependency. So implementing this efficiently involves a bunch of extra data structures in the processor. And this is why, you know, we don't commonly have you build that kind of processor, and why these sorts of processors didn't start being common until the 90s. So if this is how our processor works, we want to know, how do I reason about the performance? And we can see something here about what kind of thing is happening which is keeping us from getting higher performance. And that's that we have these dependencies where even though we have more capacity to execute instructions, we're waiting and not using all that capacity. And a good way of thinking about that is something we're going to call data flow. So I'm just going to draw a graph of the dependencies of this instruction, of these instructions. So our first add is a dependency for a second add, is a dependency for a third add, which is a dependency for adds for instruction 6 and 4. So you get this chain. And this is a useful way to visualize how a modern processor executes instructions, because our speed is determined by our longest path. We need to do 1, then 2, then 3, then 6, then 7, then 8, then 9 in order to execute this program. Yes, we also need to do instructions 4 and 5, but it's the longest path which is going to be our bottleneck. Like, we can do 4 and 5 while we're doing the rest of that chain. You know, we're going to do them in parallel, and that's what happens. We do 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5, then 1, 2, 3, then 6, then 7, then 8, then 9. We have that chain, and that's what determines our speed. We have to have each of those execute sequentially, and whichever sequence of things we have to do one after the other, whichever one of those is slowest, that's to determine how fast our program can run. Yes?
What if you have a lot of short paths and not enough
So if you have a lot of short paths and not enough parallelism, so indeed in that case your parallelism can limit you. So our goal is going to be to make sure we get our program to that point. But this sort of analysis is useful to find out, is the performance I'm getting because I don't have enough short paths? So once we know the length of once we know this chain, we can analyze sort of our theoretical best performance. So assuming we had an infinite number of ALUs, let's say, how good would it be? That's a way we can think about, do I have a problem with how many things I can do at once? And the way to think about that is, so think about these execution units. I have to run on the appropriate kind of execution unit one at a time as I go down the chain. So when I'm looking at this chain, I just say, okay, I need one cycle here, one here, one here, one here, one here, one here. I add that up for my loop, and let's say I have 1,000 iterations, I might find out, okay, this loop needs 5,000 cycles. No matter how much stuff I can do in parallel, I need 5,000 cycles. And we divide that by the number of elements, and that's what our book calls the latency bound. So the latency bound is, given this longest chain, how long does that take to run, you know, in total, possibly how long does it take to run per element, but the same idea, what's the length of the longest chain I need to actually do? So the latency bound tells me how fast can the code I have run assuming I don't need to worry about not having enough parallelism, assuming my processor has a whole bunch of ALUs, and all its out of order scheduling, all this instruction queue stuff works perfectly, how good can my program be? And if we did that analysis for that loop unrolling example, we find out that the answer was one cycle per element. And that's what was happening. That we were hitting that bound. So when we're doing this analysis, it's not always going to be so simple as our execution unit just takes one cycle per instruction. Commonly, we have different kinds of execution units, which take different amounts of time. So these execution units, which you might sometimes see referred to as functional units, they mean the same thing, is where we do the actual work, so it's like the ALU or the data cache. And these are often pipelined. So when they're pipelined, we want to care about the latency, because if I need to do an add and then add those values, I can't put in the first set of values and then the next cycle while the values are here, put in the next set, because I need them to come out and go back in. So we care about the latency of this pipeline when we're analyzing that longest chain. Even though, yes, when you have a pipeline ALU like this, we can do one add per cycle, but we can't do one add per cycle that depends on the previous add. We finish one add per cycle, but each of them takes three cycles. And we have dependencies that latency is what matters. So given that, let's say this is my ALU for doing multiplications. So how long does it take to do this set of multiplications? So figure it out, you can talk with your neighbors and see if you agree on the answer. You can draw a picture with the what happens in each cycle. That's probably the best systematic solution. Okay, who wants to share an answer? Anyone? Who's at least confident that, who needs more time? Let's start with that. Not many people though. Okay, no one wants to share an answer? Okay.
We were just talking about how you have to get the product of C and D before you multiply by B, the way the parentheses are set up. So
yeah.
It'd be three cycles there.
Yeah, so you say you've got the product of C and D, so that takes three cycles for C times D, and then we use that as input to our B times C times D, and then we use that as input to our A times B times C times D. And that means that indeed we have to do these one after the other, so it takes 9 cycles, which is what I have. Plus, if we have to spend any time forwarding values, that would be an additional time. Like if that's not instantaneous, which on some real processors it isn't, it could take a little longer. So even though we could start one multiplication every cycle, we can't start these multiplications once every cycle. So another kind of functional unit we sometimes have is one where they're not pipelined. So for example, dividers commonly work this way. So we input some values, and we have some input for the instruction queue saying, am I ready for new values? And maybe we do something iterative in this divide circuit. We're not going to talk in details about how you build a divider, but commonly they do something where they're not pipelined internally. They have some sort of iteration where they keep a value around and update a register repeatedly. And they output the value when done, along with a signal saying that it's actually the right value. So the reorder buffer can take that value and tell the instruction queue, hey, this is done. Here's these instructions to start, and so on. This is a convenient sort of interface to have, because if you think about data caches, this is also what we want to do for them. You know, we want to not have them tell us when the values are available, because it's going to take a variable amount of time. But on this type of functional unit, if we have this, then the way things are going to work is if we start a divide with this, it has this interface, well, we're not starting another divide until it finishes. So even if we have independent divides, if this is what our divider looks like, we can't do them in parallel, assuming we only have one of these dividers. Okay, so that's my overview of how functional units work and our preview of our data flow model, looking at the dependencies. And let's apply this to our loop unrolling case. So here's sort of a data flow view of our loop unrolling. I haven't written out instructions, I've just written out the operations, but each of these operations intuitively corresponds to one thing a functional unit does. So something that we kind of gloss over is that, hey, I have a load here, but where do I do the arithmetic for the address calculation? That might be multiple stages. So we might split up an instruction into multiple little sub-instructions that are in the instruction queue. But it's these fundamental operations which matter. So I have my load, I have my address calculation. This is essentially what I'm doing in the loop. And to get optimal performance, it turns out we can do three things each cycle, assuming that each of these things take one cycle. And our longest chain is this chain of sums. Like, we have to put in our initial sum, 0, and do each addition one at a time. And that ends up what limits our performance. So our book also calls this the critical path. And if we take the sum of the amount of time it takes to do each addition, that's the amount of time we need to take. So for each element, we need to do one addition. On the processor, I showed you performance results from earlier. Each addition took one cycle. That's where we got that one cycle per element value, is that we needed to wait for each addition to happen one after the other, even though that processor, it turns out, can do about 4 additions per cycle. It has 4 copies of the ALU, but it can't use all of them because it needs to wait for the results each cycle. We also have a little bit of additional extra work of like testing the conditions, which is what we were avoiding previously, but notice that that's not on the critical path. So that's why that didn't really matter once we made it a little enough work. So when loop unrolling was helping, it turned out we had enough of these comparisons that, oh, we ran out of ALUs. And that's what was happening. But it didn't actually impact our latency bound. So, you know, it only helped a little bit and then it stopped helping. So we're going to talk about how we can restructure this loop to make the latency bound shorter and not just get rid of these extra comparisons so we can find enough things to fill up all our ALUs or not have too much extra work for our ALUs. And that's how we're going to get below this limit of needing to do the additions one at a time. And to talk about that, we're going to talk about first a simpler case. So I have two things here. Let's say I have a single one multiplier, so an ALU that's pipelined and takes 5 cycles. So we can put in a new value, set of values to multiply every cycle, and we get the result after 5 cycles. So how long does this take? And assume that when we get an output from this multiplier, we can use it immediately in the next cycle, that we don't have to wait. So figure out and check with a neighbor how long each of these should take given that multiplier. Anyone willing to share answers? No one, okay. So the hint here is to think about the data flow graph. So let's start by drawing that. And the heuristic we had was to think about the longest path. And the longest path in this is we go from here, here, here. We have three multiplies. And that's going to take 15 cycles, at least. Here, our longest path has two multiplies. And you might say, OK, so that's going to take 10 cycles, but that's not quite true. If we had an infinite number of multipliers, it would take 10 cycles. But we don't. We have one. So we have to partition that one, but it's pipelined. So what we end up doing is we end up first running A times B, and then a cycle later, we run C times D, and then we can run the overall A times B times C times D. And so this means that this point is 6 cycles, so this point here, when we finish up, is 11 cycles. So we end up taking 11 cycles, and if we had another multiplier, we take 10 instead. So you can see that the latency bound isn't perfect for telling you the performance, because it doesn't take into account how much parallelism you have, but it usually gets us pretty close, and it's actually easier to do than this analysis, which if I had like all the functional units to consider is actually very tedious. And doesn't take into account other little issues like what if my instruction queue is only so big, for example. And we can see that generally the idea is we want to have more things we can do in parallel. And our benefit here is that we had two multiplies we could do in parallel. These two multiplies we do in parallel. Because we only have one multiplier, we can't do them at the exact same time, but we have the pipeline, so we're doing, so they're 4/5 overlapping, which is how we get such a good speed benefit. And you want to generally think about how can I rearrange my computation to make my data flow flatter? And this trick of changing the order of operations so I have more things to do in parallel is a very good one. And we can actually apply this trick to our loop. So we were summing up a bunch of numbers, and we can do something a little more clever, which is to take two partial sums. We can sum up the even numbers and the odd numbers separately, and then add them together at the end. And if you're just counting instructions, well, this is extra work because I have this additional sum at the end. I'm adding 6 numbers here, and I have this extra add to do it. So this seems wasteful from the point of view of counting instructions and would, in fact, be slower on the pipeline processor you implemented. But since our modern processors can do lots of things at once, so for example, my desktop can do all these operations at once. This is 6 things at a time. My desktop can do that. Can run 2 additions plus 2 additions for addresses plus 2 loads all at the same time. And given that, we have to look at the latency. We want to know what the longest chain is. And our longest chain is either from the sum at the top where we're starting to the bottom, and we have 4 adds. Sorry, we have 7 adds in total, but we have 4 adds of time. When we go down the chain, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 adds we count to add up these 6 numbers. And so that's where we're saving time. So previously, to add up 6 numbers, we needed to spend 6 adds of time. We need to do 1 add, then another up to 6 times. Here, to add up 6 numbers, we spend 4 adds of time. And if each of these adds takes 1 cycle, that means this whole thing takes 4 cycles instead of 6. So as sort of C code, you might imagine this looks kind of like this. That we have our unrolled loop, but we change our unrolled loop to not just sum into one thing, to sum into multiple things. These accumulators that get our intermediate values. And at the end, we sum up the accumulators. And we have to handle like the leftover case. And if I implement that on my processor, on my machine, it helps mostly. So I started off with my 16 times unrolled loop. I just used more and more accumulators. I started with 1, like that's the normal unrolled loop. Then I used 2, so I had some 1, some 2, and I just alternated. Then I used 4, so I had some 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 in my loop, and then added them together at the end. And you can see that I was, in fact, spending a few extra instructions. Not much, though, because I have 900 elements. So the extra adding up at the end, yes, that's more instructions, but it wasn't significant. And when I got to 2 accumulators, I got down to a bit more than half a cycle per instruction. Not exactly a half. And that seems to be about as good as I get. And then things got way worse. So what happened here? So this is something you may have read about. What was happening? Yeah.
Register spilling.
So register spilling. Can you describe what register spilling is?
We ran out of parameter registers, so we had to store some registers on the stack.
Yeah. Yeah. So we ran out of normal registers to use for our accumulators. So the compiler helpfully stored them on the stack for me. And that ended up adding a bunch of load and store operations, and that made the code slower. And that's what was happening there. So I ran out of registers, the compiler used the stack. Using the stack, even though it's all cache hits, was still slower than using registers, and it became slower, and I didn't have any additional parallelism to use. I already exhausted all the ALUs I had when I was using 2 accumulators. And if we looked at the assembly, which By the way, I strongly recommend for performance assignments, even though I know most of you won't do it. Please, you know, looking at assembly can answer questions like, why is this major change make it suddenly slow? Probably the compiler's doing something stupid. And you might be able to dissuade it from doing that by being more explicit about whatever stupid thing it's doing. But you have to read the assembly to do that. But this is the assembly I got, that the compiler decided, you know, with 8 accumulators that it used a register for everything. Okay? Seems fine. And with 16 accumulators, it did this. It like had a value on the stack that it was adding to. And this required extra operations as far as that execution. We had to send something to the load store unit, then do the addition and send something to the store unit, load store functional unit. And so it did extra cache accesses. And also we were already using all the adders, so these extra cache accesses weren't helping us at all. Right? Maybe you'd imagine if we had like 1,000 adders that this wouldn't matter. That would still have a benefit, but we didn't. We have 4. So another question you might have about this is, well, why is it 0.57? What's special about 0.57? You know, half, that makes sense. We're doing twice as much stuff at a time. And my guess is that this is the loop overhead. So this is stuff we might be able to avoid with more loop unrolling. So we have 2 additions per element, one to add to the sum, one to compute the address. And we also have some loop overhead for just manipulating I and doing the branch. And my machine can basically do 4 adds or branches per cycle. They have 4 ALUs which can do any of those operations, but only one at a time, obviously. So 4 copies of the ALU. And if we add these all up, I unroll the loop 16 times, we get exactly 0.57. So that's probably what was happening. So that 0.07 was the loop overhead. That didn't happen quite in parallel since we were using all the ALUs now. Or trying to. And this is another example of where previously we said, oh, loop unrolling doesn't help once you get above like 4. Maybe it would help more now.
If we laid out every single instruction and removed the loop altogether, would we be able to get down to 0.5?
The question is, if we laid out the instructions and removed the loop together, would we get down to 0.5? I believe so. I haven't tested that. I haven't written the, like, but I believe you would get there, or at least a lot closer. Okay, so that's about multiple accumulators, and that's the other optimization you'll need to deal with tomorrow. So I'm going to talk about a couple of miscellaneous optimizations that may or may not come up on assignments. And these are things that mostly compilers do, but I want to inform you that compilers do them so you can make sure the compiler is doing it. So one of these is for constant multiplies and divides. And you may remember that on the bit fiddling homework, we had you do something where you like use bitwise operations to do multiplications and divisions. And compilers, in fact, are really good at this. So here, we're times 5 divided by 8. The compiler figures out, OK, I can multiply by 5. I can divide by 8. That's how I'm going to do it. If you use signed ints, it's going to do this, and it's going to do all the special work to deal with the bias that you have to deal with in the homework. So it figures that out. So this is pretty simple. And you know you have shift instructions, so that makes sense. What's not intuitive is that the compiler does this for something where you don't have powers of 2, like dividing by 100. The compiler figures out, oh, 1 over 100, that's almost this number over 2 to the 37. So I'm going to multiply by that number, then divide by 2 to the 37. And that's how it does the division by 100. And it turns out that this is much faster. Division is a really slow instruction. So this ends up being faster, and compilers know to do this. So in addition to doing these sorts of tricks for multiplication, they use this sort of trick for division, which compilers can figure out. I don't expect you to do it, but you should know it happens. And something that's actionable for you as a programmer is that dividing by a constant might be much faster. Because the compiler knows about this trick, but it's not going to do it if you divide by, you know, another parameter y. Yeah?
I'm sorry, so it's divided by 100 rather than
50
something?
So the compiler, the code is dividing by 100, the C code. The compiler implements that by multiplying by this number, then dividing by 2 to the 37, because of this approximately holds. And it holds approximately enough that this is exact. And the compiler has proven that to itself, so it knows this is correct. Yes?
Does that mean that you should use magic numbers in your code?
That means you should use constants in your code. If you have like something that the compiler knows the value of at compile time, it will do this. That you don't have to hard code the value, it can be like a const int that you've declared in the header file. Okay. So another thing that compilers are pretty good at is figuring out addresses when you're accessing arrays. So if you remember our code for doing the squaring, we have all these multiplies by n. That seems kind of slow, like we have to multiply by n every time we access something. On my desktop, multiplication by n, multiplication of integers, I can do one per cycle, but it has a 3-cycle latency. So that could end up being on our critical path even. Maybe it's, you know, if you look at our data flow, depending on how things work out, it might be bad. And it takes time too. We have to use those ALUs, and we might run out of ALUs like we've seen. And compilers are actually pretty clever about this. So they can do a transformation like this, where instead of multiplying by n every time, we say, oh, you're multiplying a counter by n. Instead of multiplying that by n, I'm just going to add n. And we're going to add it to the pointer, so I don't even have to multiply by the size of each element of a. So compilers are actually pretty good at doing this transformation. So they transform this loop where we compute the index every time and then access the array, something where we keep a pointer and we increment the pointer even though it's not by one every time, even though it's by n. So that ends up being a lot faster. And so compilers usually do this to eliminate slow multiplies. So you usually don't have to. Usually if you do it yourself, probably you won't do quite as good a job. And if you want to check that the compiler did this, you can check the loop. Sometimes the compiler might not figure out to do this. The common case would be when, well, maybe it's less simple to notice that k and I change by one, k changes by one each time. If that's not so simple to figure out because you have, like, k is not just int k equals 0, k plus plus, maybe the compiler won't do it, and doing it by hand might help the compiler out. I'm mentioning this mainly because this is the sort of optimization where you change your loop so the compiler stops doing this and you're really surprised. What happened? Why is my code suddenly a lot slower? And often what happened is you changed it so the compiler figured out to do this versus didn't figure out to do this, even though it was probably possible in both cases. But the compiler just missed that, oh, that increments by one each time or two each time or whatever. So another thing compilers are good at doing are transforming something like this into this, where we compute I times n once, and then we just have these base red values that we compute in the outer loop and just use them every time, rather than adding n each time in the loop. And this can be faster, right? Assuming we have enough like registers for all the base values, it's great. So you're just computing an offset and you're adding each time. That's a nice fast operation. And this is a useful thing to do. So this is something you can see compilers doing. And the reason I'm mentioning it is sometimes this backfires. So like this is a good idea, but let's say we have 20 iterations of our loop. I've seen GCC still do this transformation, which means we have 20 base values. And if you think of how many registers you have, well, we must be using the stack. So sometimes GCC, because it's doing this, simplifying your address calculations, will end up putting stuff on the stack, even though it doesn't look like you have enough variables to do that. And you can see this by looking at the assembly code. So for example, if I look here, so here's a loop like this, and if I look at what GCC generates for some of the iterations of the loop, if I skip to like here, which is this line, you can see it uses using the stack when there's no reason to do that. And that's because it did this transformation. So usually you won't have to worry about this, but this is a reason why you might do a lot of loop unrolling and suddenly your code is way, way slower. This is one of the things which can happen. And there's an alternative of doing this transformation, which uses more registers. Sorry, it uses more additions, but less registers and less spilling, which is probably better in that case. And for some reason, GCC usually won't do it. Clang, it turns out, usually will do this in preference to the other transformation. But they're both options, and it's not clear which one is better. This is a case where the compiler doesn't know, because one of them involves using more stack space and more registers that might be inconvenient for other parts of the code, which want to use those registers. The other involves doing more additions. Like, so there's not a clear winner. But if you want the compiler to do a particular thing, well, you can write this explicit code, and it will probably do the explicit thing, which might be slower, it might be faster. But if you have reason to believe that the compiler is generating something really inefficient, like accessing the stack every time for a bunch of things, like this is a way you can tell it, please stop, I want you to just add n every time. I know there's way too much stuff, and I know this is the best way to do the address calculation. You can do that, but don't do this unless you have reason to believe the compiler screwed up. Usually, the compiler is going to do something quite fast that's probably faster than what you have guessed the first time, because it knows to like do, you know, this transformation by itself, for example, which most people don't think of the first time, and you can get wrong, and it's hard to debug. But just wanted to let you know, because I know we get lots of questions where, why is my code slow? The answer is look at the assembly, but this is some weird things compilers end up doing, which usually helps performance, but sometimes ends up doesn't help performance, or they don't do it, so you don't have that performance gain you saw with some very similar looking code. So any questions about these addressing efficiency issues? Yeah?
Can we go back to
Yeah. Or the, sorry, the actual, this.
The slide that you're talking about. Wait, I'm sorry, what's happening?
Here?
Or can we go back?
Yeah, so here, so the problem was that we have 20 of these AI-based variables.
Okay.
So while we're just adding a constant to them, like we can compute I times n, like not every time, but once in the loop, and just add it to them, we have 20 of them, so we have to load some of them from the stack.
Okay.
And what we probably should have done is this, where we have one and we add it to get to the next thing.
Can you explain the transformation one more time?
So the transformation here is that initially we have I times 0 plus n, and I'm computing, this is I times I times 1 plus n. This is I times 1 plus n. This value here is I times 1 plus n plus 0.
Okay.
I times 1 plus n plus k. And I time plus 2 times n plus k. And then we're adding the current value of I. To that each time. And so this is a trick that avoids doing quite as much work. But yeah, but really what the compiler should do, and GCC sometimes doesn't figure out, is that this, if you have a lot of them, is more efficient. If you have less of them, it's not clear. Notably, a disadvantage of this technique is that if you think about the longest chain, well, now everything is on the same chain. If you think of the data flow graph, now we have here, we have a dependency from here to here to here, whereas previously, these two operations are independent. And so that's another advantage to what GCC is doing, but the problem is that you run out of places to store the base pointers. I guess I should say that this is equal to ampersand a of k plus n k plus n times 2 and so on. And so it's not that either of them is clearly better, but you get into problems when you spill things onto the stack for any reason. Okay. So any questions about this addressing transformation? Okay, so we're not going to test you on these addressing transformations. This is mostly information because for some people it will come up on the assignments. For some people it won't. For many people it won't. But I want you to actually try to figure out what's happening and not just flail against the compiler wondering why is my compiler doing things that make no sense? Okay, So we've talked about a bunch of ways of taking advantage of our processor executing instructions out of order. So the next topic we're going to talk about, which we'll definitely need to finish up next time, is about vector instructions. So modern processors have not just the registers we know about, but they have registers which can hold a vector of values, a little array. So for example, x86-64, every x86-64 machine has 128-bit registers. So you can use that to hold 4 ints, 4 floats, 2 doubles, whatever value fits in 128 bits. They're named XMM0 through XMM15. So if you've seen assembly, you may have seen these registers. That's what they are. And there are instructions that treat the register as containing an array of values, like an array of floats, and act on all the values in the register. These are called vector instructions, or SIMD, for single instruction, multiple data. And basically, there are extra copies of the ALU, which typically are only accessed by the vector instructions. And the advantage here is that with less code and therefore less work with our instruction queue and all those things which track dependencies, we can do more operations. So to give a simple example, one of the vector instructions is padd, which stands for packed add d word. D word means double word, which means a 32-bit value because x86 has some history. So if our register contains 128 bits, so let's say we treat that 128 bits as 4 32-bit integers. So let's say XMM0 contains 1, 2, 3, 4. XMM1 contains 5, 6, 7, 8. If we execute this instruction, then XMM1 is going to contain 6, 1 plus 5, 2, 8, 2 plus 6, 10, 3 plus 7, and 12, 4 plus 8, with one instruction. And it turns out that this instruction takes essentially the same amount of time to run as a normal add. But we do 4 adds. Yes?
Did you not also mention that the ALU for this is a separate one, so it wouldn't be in like the critical path?
So the question is the ALU for this a separate one? So when I say extra copies of the ALUs, essentially each of our ALUs has like three extra copies for the purpose of this. What actually happens is that we can build an ALU which can have variable size additions, but we don't talk about how ALUs work, so we don't discuss that. But basically, the efficiency for doing these 128-bit operations is the same as doing a normal register add with normal registers. Yes? Do you have to worry about overflow is the question. When we do this adds, it's like we're doing normal 32-bit adds. So it's like we did four 32-bit adds, except the condition codes aren't set. Yeah, so like we did like add L. So it's like we did four add L instructions as far as the values computed, except the condition codes just aren't set at all. Okay, so we'll talk more about this next time. Here's sort of actual assembly code preview.